The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm joined by Chris Zielinski, the Senior Culinary Director with Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, in a super cool room that I've never been in before. And I've been at the ACC many times for my other day job as sports media with TSN Radio. But Chris, thank you so much for doing this.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, this as I say, the podcast, I want it to not just be about people totally into wine, but people that are into food, people that are in entertainment and hospitality. So I appreciate you doing this. And I'll start here because I went on your Instagram account. What tastes best coming out of the Grey Cup? Like, if you could recommend a beverage, what would you recommend?
For the Grey Cup?
For the Grey Cup.
Well,
unfortunately, I can't do the Stanley Cup. We won't do those jokes. But I saw a picture with you and Chad Kelly, Argonauts backup quarterback, holding the Grey Cup.
Yeah. You know what? I mean, I think it was a champagne moment there. You know, I mean, I was so happy for those guys. You know, they worked so hard. The game was crazy. Like,
Yes. What
a wild finish. And, like, you know, people say anything can happen in the CFL. Well, anything did happen that day. And you know what? I just love the fire. When Chad Kelly came walking up to me with that cup in his hand, he was like, "You got to hold this." And I'm like, "Yeah, I got to hold this."
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
that's fantastic.
So then we took the picture together and, you know, just what a great day. And, you know, I've been very lucky to be a part of some of these great winning experiences. 13 years I've been here.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, we didn't do a lot of winning. There was a lot of talk of winning. There was a lot of descriptions about what it might feel like when we win. But we pretty much won every trophy except one.
Except for one.
Since I started, which is fantastic. It's been so exciting.
It's funny. Now I want to go down like a complete tangent about Marc Gasol and how much Spanish rosé did he consume on the top of that bus. But maybe we'll save that. I'll just say this.
I could tell you this. Yeah. I could tell you this, that we had to reload that bus. By the time it got from exhibition to here, it was all gone.
Okay, what does that mean? Okay. What does that mean, reload the bus?
So, you know what? Obviously, there was a plan for how that parade was going to go.
Yeah.
X amount of time. But of course, once, you know, you throw 2.5 million people into the middle of the road, it slows
it
things
changed.
Down. You know, and so, you know, they're coming down and they were supposed to be here at a certain time. An hour later, we were still like peeking around the corner.
Yeah, I remember.
We get the call and it's like, they've drank everything. They've sprayed everything. You know, we need to load it up. So, you know, a couple of people went down to the warehouse, grabbed all the best stuff we had and loaded it onto a trolley and literally ran out there and filled the bus again right outside of 11 Restaurant.
I promise very soon I want to talk about your journey. But now I have one more follow up. Does it annoy you as much as it annoys me when I see a team celebrating and usually not the championship, like say in baseball when you clinch the division and the announcers say, "Oh, they're spraying champagne." And I look at the bottle, I'm like, no, that's Prosecco.
Well,
that is not champagne. Get it right.
Absolutely. And really, who would actually take Veuve Clicquot and spray it for no reason? Like it is a... It is a prized possession, and people should be putting that into their mouths.
Yes.
And that's why there is Prosecco and other great sparkling wines out there that were just invented for these types of occasions.
Absolutely. All right, Chris, so let's just start with the most obvious question. Just being the senior culinary director of Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, that means, you know, your main job is helping feeding thousands and thousands of people in a variety of different venues watching a variety of different sports. But I'm just curious, like what is a day in life? Like what are the main components of your job?
Well, you know, I would describe myself as the orchestra leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a big army of cooks and chefs. We have 20 different chefs, executive chefs, sous chefs, chef de cuisines, all of them with their own skills and their own abilities and their own taste buds. And it's my job to guide them on that journey to make sure that, you know, everybody's getting what they want, when they want, in a timely manner. And we're making it exciting, you know, finding exciting new ideas and creating experiences for the fans. So the fans come here already. They're already excited about the game. You know, they've got the tickets in their pocket, well, on their phone now. But in the old days, they would have been in
the
pocket.
In the pocket. Yeah.
And they're already excited. You know, I always tell people, like, you know, the biggest difference between this job and working in restaurants outside is that when you go to when you work in a restaurant outside, anything can happen in that restaurant. People come and break up with their girlfriends at the restaurant.
Right.
People come and have fights at the restaurant, and that doesn't happen here. People are so excited when they come in the door. They already have a smile on their face. They already know they're in for a good time. And so our job is just to try to elevate that experience and make sure that we can add, you know, just another level of flavor and excitement to the whole evening.
And we'll get into some of the new menu items. I was part of the media event that day. Holy Lord, did I go home just so full. I was so full. And I was like, I can't eat another delicious thing. And we'll get into this in a second. But how difficult is it to have such range of the menu? I saw a quote. I think it was yours. We serve food at every level, popcorn to foie gras. That has to be tricky, not just in the sourcing of it, but just trying to figure out what works best with each different element.
Well, you know, it all starts with the fans. If the fans don't want it, we don't need to make it, right? Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, chefs can be very ego-driven and very like, you know, I'm going to do what I like. This is my dish. Why don't people like my dish? I look at it the opposite way. It's like we've got 19,000 people coming. Maybe 100 of them might want foie gras.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a lot more people that want the popcorn. And trying to find the sweet spot in the middle. We always try to, you know, buck in on trends and get, you know, on board with things that people are talking about in the city. But we have some very different audiences. A Leaf audience is very different than a Raptor audience.
Mm-hmm.
A TFC audience is very different than an Argos audience in the same building. They have, you know, a completely different set of taste buds, different demographic, different vibe. So I got to find the sweet spot, and that's what the team does. They bring forth ideas. Some of the ideas are, you know, a little too crazy. Some of them are not crazy enough.
Yeah.
And it's my job to try to guide it to the just crazy enough spot where people will be excited and they'll want to try it.
Is there a specific one? And if you don't have, like, if you don't have one that comes to mind and jumps at you later, please feel free. But just like an idea that was like too crazy. Like for me, for instance, if I was trying to sell you on the wine side, I'd be like, no. Everyone needs German Mosel Riesling. Trust me, it goes great with everything. What do you mean that's going to be hard to sell? That would be my crazy one. But what about on the food side?
So we used to do this little game with the TFC fans back in the day when we were trying to like get them more interested in the food program before all of our renovations and all of our championships and all that. And we would get them a bunch of them down for a tasting, just like the one you came to.
Mm-hmm.
And we would trot out all the new flavors and all, and then we'd always add a couple of wild cards in there just to see what the reaction was. So we did this delicious haggis sandwich. It was delicious. There was absolutely nothing wrong with it. But the room told me immediately they did not want a haggis sandwich.
Right.
We like to think that we're like a little bit, you know, British when we come to our soccer love. And the truth is we're not as Scottish as we think.
No. Okay. That is a great one. But that totally makes sense. It's so aspirational. It's like, let's get this on there. And yeah, and then you're going to get the record scratch and everyone's going to go 180. That's a great one. What's your own? I'd love to hear more just about your journey, about how, you know, what were the steps that led you now to being the senior culinary director?
Well, you know what I mean? Like anybody, when you're, you know, 18 and you're looking for a job, you don't really know exactly mm-hmm. what it's going to be. I mean, some people might have that kind of clarity, but I certainly wouldn't fall in that category. I grew up in Michigan. I was born in Detroit, and my family wasn't a particularly culinary family.
Mm-hmm.
My mother and father were very busy. My dad doesn't know how to cook a damn thing to this day. Really, you know, in my family, the only one who really, like, you know, rolled it out was my grandmother, Polish family on both sides. But actually, both grandmothers were, like, really into it. And we would go to their house. And I can remember waking up in the morning and she'd be, it'd be like 8 in the morning and there's already, like, fresh cinnamon rolls coming out of the oven. And she'd be making all these poppy seed biscuits and different, you know, Polish treats. And she did it because we were there, you know, and it was, like, you know, a real experience. But it did show me that, you know, that there was passion that could be involved in the whole process. Fast forward to me moving here when I was 19 and moved right downtown Toronto from a fairly suburban setting in Western Michigan.
That must have been a bit of a culture shock.
Absolutely. But something I was very ready for. Right. You know what? I'm, you know, a big music person. I, you know, love food, all that sort of good stuff. And moving right to Dundas University in the downtown of a giant big city. And all of a sudden, everything I wanted to taste and sample and see was right outside my door. But you need money to taste it and sample it. So I had to get a job. So I got a job in a restaurant that was just kind of I would describe it as a, you know, fast casual type place. That was in the wrong spot in the city, but it, you know, it happened to work out. They opened, they hired me. I was in the busboy on the floor. I was bar back, you know, doing a whole bunch of front of house duties. And one day somebody didn't show up in the kitchen and they said, "Do you want to work in the kitchen?" I'm like, "Well, okay, I'll give it a go. We'll see what happens." But it was exciting, you know, it was fun. All of a sudden I was creating something. And one of the greatest joys that I found in this type of work in general is that it's one of the very few jobs where you get to see the immediate result of your work. You can see the look on somebody's face. You can see the, you know, the excitement of eating a dish. And, you know, that you just don't get that kind of gratification if you're at a bank necessarily or, you know, in other places. So so I really, you know, caught on to that. I got very lucky early on where I was you know, working in a couple of restaurants downtown with some very good chefs. A friend of mine, Michael Olson, who's down in Niagara College, we were living together at the time, going to George Brown College. And he said, "Well, let's go check out this new restaurant. There's this guy, Susan Lee, who's making some interesting food over on Tecumseh Street."
What year was this?
Oh, God.
Around?
89 something. So like, it was a long time ago.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, it was Susser's first restaurant. It was called Lotus, and it was on Tecumseh. And really, it was, for Toronto, it was a really, you know, a totally different experience than something that had been out there before. It was somewhat casual, but the food level was super high, and, you know, everything being made from scratch. They'd only been open for 2 weeks, and we went in for dinner, and the person who was working as his sous chef, he wasn't crazy about the way it was going. So he sat down with us afterwards. We chatted. We had some wine. We had a good time. And then he was like, "Well, are you looking for a job?" And I said, "Sure, I'll give it a go." And that started a pretty exciting journey at that point. 2 years working side by side with Suzer in this tiny little kitchen.
Crazy.
Making everything from scratch.
Yeah.
Like, literally, the only thing we didn't make was bread, and we did that sometimes as well. But, you know, at 3 o'clock, it'd be, "Well, what kind of ice cream should we make?" And people are coming at 5:30. You know, like, it was literally spontaneous.
That's a lot of pressure. Like, that must have been, like, on one level, very creatively satisfying, but that's also a lot of pressure.
But it taught me so much. And I think about, like, the other people that did that job after me, Robert Bartley, who was the chef that hired me here. He's since been traded to the Canucks. Mm-hmm. Lorenzo, who's been at George Restaurant for a very long time. Both of them have very similar characteristics from learning the craft in that type of setting. They're both very devoted to the details. They both get very excited about food and ideas. And, you know, and I would thank Suzer for that opportunity. And it really started a bigger journey for me.
By the way, you mentioned from Detroit. When Dwayne Casey comes to town, who are you rooting for, the Pistons or the Raptors?
Well, you know what? I mean, the Pistons have had their moments.
They had their
bad boy moments back when I could still support them. But I am like crazy about NBA basketball. Like, when it comes to the Raptors, and we can all go back to that day when we found out there was going to be a team, and my friend Marty and I, and we're just like, "Whoa, this is exciting. This is happening. It's really happening." You know, I voted in the naming contest. I didn't pick Raptors, by the way.
What did you remember? Did you do Towers?
I think I did Towers.
Towers,
yeah.
Yeah.
But you know what? I was there on opening day at the Dome, the worst possible setting for a basketball game, and it didn't matter.
Really was.
Yeah. But, at that time, it was not really even on my radar that I would end up here.
Of course.
There was a lot of things that happened in between, a lot of great restaurants I worked in. But Brad Long, who was the chef here, right from the beginning when they opened it as Air Canada Center, I always thought, you know what? That is a cool job. that is a really cool job. And, you know, I talked to Brad and he, you know, it was crazy. Imagine trying to open this thing. You know, I had the luxury of coming in after the thing was like a running, mm-hmm. you know, functioning device. And I didn't have to come in and try to invent the wheel. So kudos to Brad for inventing the wheel.
How different is it now versus when you started?
Well, we've expanded dramatically. So when I started, we had, you know, Air Canada Center, fairly simple offerings, and almost the clubs had almost the same menus everywhere. You know, we had our simple offerings. We didn't do a lot of scratch cooking on the concourse. BMO was an afterthought at that point. We really didn't do anything over there. Coca-Cola Coliseum was running from a different caterer. Real sports had not been invented yet.
Right.
11 had not been invented yet.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah, that is ages. Yeah.
So, literally everything that has been added has kind of been added since my time. So, you know, I like to think it's pretty dramatic. You know, the scale and the scope is definitely, you know, massive compared to where we used to be. And likewise, the sales reflect that. So, yeah, it's exciting. Yeah.
And what's your role with Real Sports, with 11?
So,
and know, also started, and then there's the like the Hot Stove Club and the Platinum Club. Like there's a lot of different like food options and hanging out options within 500 feet of where we're sitting.
So, you know, we've got a lot of great chefs, as I mentioned earlier, and they all have a lot of great ideas. You know, my role is to make sure, you know, you think about a big ship and Real Sports being a giant ship in itself. I mean, 700 seat restaurants just don't happen. There is a lot of work to keep a ship going straight. And once a ship starts to curve, you know, a little bit out to the right and an ocean liner, you can't just turn left.
Right.
You know, you gotta guide it back in. So it's my job to make sure that the vision stays true. Like what these guys are coming up with still makes sense to sports fans, but, you know, still test the waters, but are exciting. For 11, you know, it's North American classics. And I can tell you that restaurant itself was really Larry Tannenbaum's, you know, baby. He absolutely loved a couple of restaurants in New York. So Robert Bartley and myself, he said, go down to New York and eat in these restaurants, and I want to have something like that. And so we went down there, and we ate everything on the menu. The servers thought we were absolutely bonkers. You know, and we were literally picking everything apart, tasting little bits, and they were laughing at the way we were, you know, being so scientific about it. But that was Mr. Tannenbaum's vision. And you know what? We came back, took some of those ideas, Canadianized some of the ideas, because I think they were, you know, fairly American. And really, 11 has been, you know, that North American classic, you know, wheelhouse, which, you know, which changes. You know, we have things on there like Bao's now and some, you know, different items. But it changes with the taste buds of the population. It doesn't necessarily set the trend. It keeps with trend, I would say. And you know what? It's consistency. So I go over and I taste food in every single location. I try to, you know, every day try a little bit of this from everywhere. Obviously, I'd be 800 pounds if I ate in every restaurant every single day. But you know what? Being present, tasting food, analyzing food, having the chefs taste their own food. You know, this is where my job is critical. It's just to making sure that everybody's really focused on the vision and what it's supposed to be.
I want to have a question about science versus art, but one little aside, and you just mentioned 11, the one thing you were talking about trends and creating that restaurant. I don't know why I thought about this, but that was the first restaurant I was ever at where I was given an iPad for the wine list. And I found it fascinating because you could, on one level, it annoyed the hell out of me because I'm not a big tech guy. At the time, I probably had a BlackBerry. But then as I thought about it, it was a great way to help guide someone because there'd be categories of what style of wine do you want? Or it's just like, okay, do you have a country? Oh, you like that country? Press this button. Here are the regions. Like on one level, it could be both very confusing. But on another level, it could really kind of help someone on their wine journey if they're insecure about it.
Absolutely. You know, and I think we had people on both sides of the fence. I was actually going to ask you, how did you feel about that? Because
I hated it for the I hated it for the first half hour. But part of that is just like when I get a new phone, I'm miserable for a week because I'm trying to figure it out. But then once I sort of intellectualized what it was, once I could figure it all out, I loved it. You know, that then at that point, I loved it for me, but then I also loved it for the consumer.
I would say that if I was to sort the groups, under 35,
yeah,
loved it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe over 40, there was
trepidation.
A little bit of, you know, like, oh, can I just get a piece of paper?
Yes.
Even to the, that still happens today, you know, during COVID, we had, you know, the barcodes that people were scanning. And, you know, it worked for the time. Then we weren't handing out menus to everybody and everybody was touching them and all that sort of stuff. And I think a lot of people under the age of 35 are just used to that idea. And still some restaurants still run that way. But it doesn't sit well with a lot of people. They want to hold the menu in their hand.
It's
they
the tactile feel, it. Feel, yes. Yeah.
It's like reading a newspaper online. It's just less satisfying.
It really is. It's something, there's just something about a wine menu that I like to see it all in front of me. I don't like to... But at the very least, with when you guys were doing it, it was to help divide, to get people to where they wanted to go quicker. Like I actually thought it was really clever. When I saw it, I was probably under 30, or I was probably around 35, and it just took me a minute. But again, I hate technology.
I think there's a lot of people who it was a bit of a wake-up call for them because they didn't know where they wanted to go.
Right, yeah.
You know, they didn't ever think of it being sorted like that or having to hit tabs and you know, think about it in a, you know, in the varietal versus country versus, you know, just likes and dislikes. Typically, you know, when you get it, you have two types of wine lists. You have the ones where it's these are the hand selected ones. It's a one pager. You know, they've got some great, interesting options on there. And I think there's a lot of restaurants around Toronto who do a great job of curating these types of lists. And then you have what we have, which is a book.
Yeah.
You know, it is got, you know, 10 different versions of the same wine, you know, if you want to go down that road, you know, and that's not everybody can walk into that and feel comfortable or know where to go. And that's why we have, 11 sommeliers on our team on any given day, because, you know, we have to curate that for the customer in very short order. Everybody's getting ready to go to the game. You know, the wine, I think the tablets worked really well for some people. They were able to like get where they wanted, but I think it confused some people and it told them something about themselves they didn't know.
That's true. What is the wine pro? Actually, no, I'll go back there in a second. But you were talking before about when you would go to these restaurants in New York, and you talk about in one article I read about you about taste everything, taste little bites, smash it, chew it, add things, put it on a bun. How much of being a cook or how much of it is science and how much of it is art?
Well, when I think about the art side of it, you know, I'm a person. And I realize that every person has a sort of their own take on this. When it comes to food, when it comes to wine, when it comes to music, you know, I don't want to have the thing I've had 20 times. I'm not really that. I like to hear new music. I like to try new things. You know, when I think about wine in particular, I think when somebody does something bold and they do something different, and it may be different, not in a higher way. So, you know, the example that I've used in the past is Bonnie Doone, who kind of...
Randall Graham, former guest on this podcast.
Oh, fantastic.
I love Bonnie Doone. Oh, it's so good.
So,
great Grenache.
Yeah, like you think about, you know, what they did with wine and how they sort of changed that, you know, that pattern of it's always got to be bigger and better and a bigger flavor bomb and all that sort of stuff. And they said, no, we're going to blend this. We're going to mix it up. We're going to do something you haven't tried before. We're going to put a cigar on the label for no reason.
Yep.
A flying one of that.
Yeah.
And we're going to put a screw cap on it.
Yep.
And you know what? And that's what's going to happen. And you know what? We went to the winery and it was like, you know what? I didn't necessarily get it before I walked in. But we walked in there and we were in the setting. You're in Santa Cruz in the mountains. It's gorgeous. All this great stuff going on. And then you try the wine and you hear the story and you hear how people speak of the wine. And like that is, you know, it changed a lot of things. I think it changed the expectations for a lot of people. You know, and they're still making great wines today. But that's what I look for. You know, that's when I go out to eat, that's what I want to see, is who's doing it differently. Who's mixing it up still with quality. You know, I mean, obviously quality has to be number one, but I'll go to the restaurant and I'll order the weirdest things on the menu almost every single time. Took my kids to Spain. You know, we were eating out in all these crazy places in San Sebastian and Girona and Barcelona. And I'm like, what is the weirdest thing on this menu? We're going to order it right every time. And you end up with some amazing dishes.
What do your kids think of that when you order the weird? Are they in, or are they like, Dad, get the hell out of here, I want a burger?
They were on the cusp of understanding that.
Right,
I think that trip actually really changed because they were, you know, late teenagers. My son, who was 16 at the time, he was a lot more on board. I mean, he wasn't that crazy about eating that little, you know, there's a little pincho. It had like about 80 eels, baby eels on it. And I'm like, okay, we got to have that, right? And that, I think that was over the line.
That's fine. That's, you know, that's fair. That's fair.
But I ate them.
Yeah, of course you did. I would have eaten that as well.
Same as the spleen sandwich
in
Sicily. You know, you got to have it.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
Man, I have a friend who said, I have a 2000 Margaux, but we're going to be pairing it with testicle. And I'm like, and worm dust, literally ground worm dust. And it actually paired well. You give me a 2000 Margaux, I don't care what the food is, I will try it. There really is no.
I'll take that chance.
Yeah, I'll take 100 times out of 100. By the way, this is way off topic, and now I'm just making this about me. If someone said Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment is either going to acquire a three-point shooter for the Raptors or back vintage Bonnie Doon, I would take the back vintage Bonnie Doon. Does MLSE, do you have any back vintage Bonnie Doon anywhere within any of your restaurants?
I don't think so.
Ah,
I don't think so. You know what? We, you know, it's very demand driven. If you were here asking for it every night, I can guarantee we'd find it.
Yeah.
We have ways of finding these things.
Of course. Of course.
But we do need a three-point shooter.
Yeah, that is true. It's a slump right now. But as we record, we're recording this on December 15th. Hopefully by the time I release this episode, the three-point shooting will have corrected itself. By the way, Scotty Barnes, a hell of a passer. What is the wine program? If you were going to describe the wine program at a Leaf game or a Raptor game, what would it be?
So, the Leaf crowd, it's you know, there's a lot of, it's fairly corporate. You know, when I think about Platinum Club in particular, where we sell a lot of wine. I think, you know, when it comes to wine sales and cheese sales, you know, those two things are best friends.
Yep.
They have been for a long time. I don't think there's a lot of places, you know, in the city can even compare with the amount of cheese. We do have the cheese curated by Afram himself. You know, we have a great cheese program, but the wine program is, you know, I think second to none. It's very, you know, geared to the audience. I would say we're not straying into the orange territory very often.
Just be ego.
Yeah.
That would just be showing off your experiences of the wines you love. That wouldn't be doing a service. Of course, we're getting an orange wine. I don't think I want it on any of my menu. Well, you know what? No, I'm not going to rip on orange wine now. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, you know what? We know our audience. They love, you know, they love their California Cabs. They love, you know, there's certain labels that will always sell. They love, you know, Super Tuscans. You know, they're big on anything Brunellos and Barolos do well in the hot stove in particular. We have a little more of Italian flavor up there.
Yep.
But then when you go to a Raptor night, you know, we would sell definitely a lot more sort of Pinot and, you know, Syrah, that type of thing, lighter reds. But as well, we would, you know, I might actually sell some white wine on those nights as well. But they love their cocktails.
Yeah.
The kids these days, they're all about the cocktails.
They are. They are all the zero calorie cocktail. If you like everything, you love nothing. And I find everything within that White Claw world, it tastes. Remember when the TV would go all fuzzy? Just go. That's what White Claw tastes to me. It tastes like my TV set at midnight back in the mid 80s when everything would just go to white fuzz.
Yeah. And if you'd had enough glasses of wine at that point, you'd probably stare at it for a while.
You would. But my preference is usually I'll go with a Chardonnay I recognize. I'll just go like, if I, my drink of choice when I come to games, it'd be a couple Chardonnay and then maybe a beer. That's usually my path.
Well, you know, the one thing that a lot of people don't realize about our program here is that it's very unique within the NBA and the NHL and NFL, baseball, you pick any sport. This is really, you know, a machination of Larry Tannenbaum's vision that he didn't want to do it the way everybody else did it.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of places would have Levy restaurants or Center Plate, Aramark, all the big names that are out there that do this type of work. And because those are all contracted, you know, situations where they pay for time or, you know, there's pounding.
Don't worry about the pounding in the background. Are you kidding? I've had podcasts with dogs barking all the time or in like crazy vineyards with horrible reverb. This is delightful.
Okay, great. We'll keep going then.
Yeah.
So, you know, the vision is always to do things from scratch. And that doesn't happen in most arenas. Most arenas have a buffet that is the same in all three clubs. The buffet is there as a function of trying to sell more tickets. In Carolina, I want to get people to come to a hockey game. I have to give them food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to give them food. We are the exact opposite. Nobody has to eat here. You know, it's pricey. Everybody knows it's pricey. It's pricey to eat. It's pricey to get a ticket. It's pricey to get in the building. It's pricey. And our restaurants are pricey within the building. But, you know, we try to compete with the best restaurants in the city for quality, you know, the skill. You know, we have to do it in a crazy fast fashion. But, you know, it is very much an anomaly. I've only been to two other arenas. I've been to a lot of arenas. Only two where they really have any sort of a la carte service. And, you know, it was an interesting experience. I was down in Brooklyn last year, and we did a tour of that arena as well as the new Islanders arena on the same day. And there is a club there that's a beautiful club. I mean, gorgeous. They did a beautiful job setting it up. They kind of mucked up the kitchen a little bit, but I'll give them a break on that. But they're doing something very similar to the Platinum Club and trying, you know. And I went in there, and I didn't know. We weren't really introduced to anybody. But the chef was in there, and they were like, oh, please meet so-and-so from Maple Leaf Sports and whatever. And I said, so what's the sort of vision here? And he goes, well, our bosses went to Toronto, and they ate in a place called the Platinum Club.
Oh.
And they said, go there, try it, and that's what we're going to do.
It was like the reverse, like when you did 11 way back in the day.
Absolutely, yeah. So,
awesome.
I was like, that's very complimentary.
Yeah.
So there's people trying to do it.
Yeah.
But you've got to break a lot of tradition, and you've got to have trust from the ownership group that it's going to work. And because we've had that culture here since day one, of, you know, this cooking from scratch, and, you know, the a la carte restaurants and wine programs and you know, you name it. You know, every single touch that we put on the food, and even in the concessions, we make a lot of that from scratch. That is a testament to Mr. Tannenbaum's vision. And you know what? The fans are so used to it. I think if you switched it, they'd be shocked at how different it got.
Yeah.
In such a short order.
Well, I imagine a lot of Toronto fans, they don't go to other places, don't realize that we are spoiled here. And I will compliment you, and I want you to brag for a bit, because after, like, when I went to the media event, you know, there was no please try food and then say nice things on air. It was more I came, and then one of the hosts from the morning show came, and we had an incredible time. And when you have Alouette, food from there, Cherry Street Barbecue, which is 5 minutes from where I live, which I absolutely love. I went on air and I said, okay, people out there, here's what you got to do. They open the doors at 6 p.m. Go at 6 p.m., try a bunch of the different concessions, and allow the, and I still call it the ACC, apologies to Scotiabank. I still call it Skydome. It happens. But just go there right when they open and allow the arena to be your restaurant. And then when the game starts, just grab a large popcorn or whatever you want, because you're already good and satiated. But brag a little bit about the food that you guys are serving here now.
Well, you know, I'm always proud of what we do. I think it takes a lot to keep it on track. It takes a lot to always have it be consistent and great. But I am so proud of what our chefs put out there and what they create. And, you know, we do those tastings, like the one you were invited to tell people, you know, people are such creatures of habit. I sit in section 122. Mm-hmm. So I'll go to 122 and I'll only eat in the one that's right to the left or just to the right.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, no, you're missing out.
Yeah.
So we love it when you guys come and you tell that story for us and say, you know what, if you don't go try Wicked Carib, then you are making a horrible mistake.
Yes, you are.
Because that food is fantastic.
Yep.
You know, and having partners like Allo, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Michelin star restaurant right
yeah.
here. And, you know, and we're, you know, we're great friends. We have a great working relationship with them and Cherry Street. You know, Lawrence is a huge fan. The teams actually get Cherry Street barbecue as well. Like, they love it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we work very closely with these partners and our internal, and every time we add something new and something bigger and something better, it pushes the level of everything below it as well. The standard goes up.
Right.
And, you know, that's the exciting part of my job. It's not just wake up, do it all over again. It's how can we make it better? How can we go one step further to make it more exciting, more interesting, but not scare anyone off at the same time?
So not serving haggis.
Not yet. We'll see.
How different is your job when this arena, this city is hosting the NBA All-Star Game, or when the NBA Finals were going on, or the MLS Cup, like things like that, you know, and the Grey Cup as well. But how different is your job, especially like an All-Star Game where it's all just big celebrity celebration parties?
Yeah, I mean, the NBA All-Star Game was probably one of the wildest experiences because the list of demands was just all over the place. And,
yeah.
You know, and we're, you know, we had sort of the expectations. We had the big tent set over there by the roundhouse, you know, freezing.
So cold.
Back and forth.
It was yeah. so cold.
You know, but the events that were going on here were exciting and the fans were into it. But that was nothing compared to the excitement of the number of different requests we got from every sort of player group. You know, everybody thinks, you know, like a basketball team, these guys are all going into one locker room together. No, doesn't work like that. I mean, it's, you know, everybody's got their own list of demands and they're generally traveling with an entourage of some sort. You know, we were literally hosting in every possible nook and cranny in this building and everybody had a different request, and you know, right up to Adam Silver himself, you know, there was, you know, without saying too much here, we literally had to have a meal for him in every single location he might step into.
Right. Wow.
You know,
that's like, a lot of work for you and your entire staff. Okay.
It was exhausting. I'm gonna say I was probably, in that 8-day span of getting ready and whatever, I was probably here, oh, I don't know, like 16 hours a day,
right?
Every single one, you know, it was wild.
Go home, get 5 hours sleep, and then rinse and repeat. Is one thing I've noticed, certainly, even in hockey, I mean, start with basketball, but even in hockey, the tastes for athletes with wine used to be, the stereotype would be, okay, it's Australian, it's Silver Oak, it's Camus, you know, and now it's, you have like branching out into southern France rosés. There's a love of Chateauneuf-du-Pape, and you know, I don't know how much is into Burgundy yet, but I was wondering just your own thoughts on professional athletes and their relationship with wine now versus maybe when you started here.
Well, it's an interesting question because I mean, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of people wading into it.
Yeah,
no pun intended. No,
oh God. Okay. The Dwayne Wade Cabernet,
you know, which is, you know, is great and it's exciting. And I think it opens the market up to a lot of fans mm-hmm. Who may not have thought of wine as a choice. You know, that's an expensive entry point for Dwayne's product, but,
I wouldn't suggest, you don't have to comment. I will. I tried it recently. I was not a fan, but again, if you like everything, you love nothing. I was not a fan of the Dwayne Wade Cabernet, but there's other athletes. Drew Bledsoe makes great wine. So
yeah, there's a lot of great musicians out there doing the same thing,
yes.
too. You know, the one thing about the players and how they associate with this building is that they're at work. You know, they come here for work. So
right. yeah.
there is no wine chatter.
Right.
You know, outside of, you know, Shanny's requests for, you know, he likes certain wines, you know, everybody, and that's, you know, after the game, not during the game.
Yeah, of course.
There is a work focus here that people come here to do their jobs.
Yeah.
And everybody else is enjoying wine. Except them.
Except for them. It's so true. By the way, I would be the worst. If I was Kyle Dubas, I would have a decanter and I would have a glass the whole time. I'd probably get fired and draft the wrong person. But you're right. This is the work environment for everyone else, but just not. It's a work environment for the players and the coaches. And then there's 18,000 people that are there to eat, drink, and be entertained.
Yeah, can you imagine if, you know, Joe Bowen's making that call?
Yeah,
what's Kyle opening over there? Yeah. You know, it's that's like a Camus.
Yeah. what vintage? Oh, Kyle, that is a bad vintage, Kyle. That is a stocky year. There is going to be a lot of green notes on that. You're going to need to decant that at least until the third period. That would be me if I was Joe Bowen. Again, I would be fired pretty much right away.
We're all at work. When we're here, we're at work.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. As we end this, just, and I know you've talked about this a bunch of times, and in fact, you were on our station once talking about it, but the 2020 bringing Toronto back to its feet program, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of meals for frontline workers. I mean, it was an incredible accomplishment by you, by MLSC, by everyone involved. And now that you've had a couple of years to sort of look back at it, what are your memories of those crazy months?
Well, you know what I mean? Extremely proud moment for myself. You know, it was but also for our team.
Yeah.
You know, at the beginning, the level of insurity that was out there and people even just wanting to be in the same room together was just,
yeah,
like, seemed like such an outrageous idea at the time. And, you know, I'm so proud of our team where, you know, we said, listen, we're going to do something. And we started with this very small idea. It was like, okay, why don't we do something for the, you know, people who are working in, you know, fire stations and, you know, and trying to do something nice for people who have to go to work. It ballooned, you know, massively when we started talking about it at a higher level. And Michael Friesdahl was very supportive. He was very on board. He said, listen, we got to do something big because we're a big, you know, we're a big player in the city. We meet lots of people. They spend a lot of money in our building, and it's time to return the favor. And people were scared. You know, it was very trepidatious. So, you know, we went through this great long plan of figuring out how to execute this in a way that we could all stay 6 feet apart and still get the work done, because that's not how kitchens work.
No, everyone's on top of each other.
You know, we figured out how to spread out the floor. We got a lot of the employees in this building engaged, especially the full-time employees, to come down and work a day, you know, out there. The first few days were, you know, okay, we're going to make, 1,000 meals, 2,000 meals. We were up to 10,000 meals a day, and that's with only 10 people cooking all that food.
Jesus.
So 10 people would cook 10,000 meals in a day. We'd have another, you know, 30 or 40 out on the floor, socially distanced. We'd crank the music out there. I got the DJs to come in and set us up with the sound system on right at the beginning, because I said there's no way people are going to want to be out there working. You know, middle of the day, I'd go out, tell dad jokes because the mood would get a little bit heavy, and, you know, like, we just found ways to make it entertaining. We did, you know, we had days where we were, you know, announcing people like they were going into a UFC fight, and, you know, it just tried to keep it fresh and exciting. And, you know, I think at the end of it, like the last day that we got it done, I think, you know, the proudest moment for me was the fact that nobody got sick.
Right.
You know, we did all this great stuff, but we did it, and we did it safely, which was, I could see the whole thing crashing in 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
From the beginning, I was just like, okay, fun idea, but what happens when all of a sudden two or three people get sick? And you know, and at that time, it was seemed very, you know, critical. Getting sick was obviously something you didn't want. So super proud of how we got through all that. And, you know, I mean, honestly, I can't think of another prouder moment in my career.
It was an incredible story at a time when we needed to hear these cool stories. So, I mean, good for you and for every member of your staff and for Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment and everyone involved. It was a hell of an undertaking and certainly helped this city.
Just glad we could do it.
Absolutely.
You know, and it kept the team together, too. It kept us all close.
Right.
Which was great.
Chris, really, really appreciate doing this. I want to tell everyone right now, get down for the next Raptor or Leaf game. Find yourself a rice dog. Get yourself a baby back rib sandwich, and you'll enjoy it just as much as you will any other restaurant around around the Scotia Bank Arena. Chris Zielinski, Senior Culinary Director with Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. Really appreciate you doing the pod today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me at Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.